Genesis chapter 37 begins a whole new series, begins a whole new focus. It's now speaking about the generations of Jacob, but focused on one individual from chapter 37 all the way to the end of Genesis will be the individual Joseph. Joseph is an amazing character, a remarkable type of Jesus. In fact, there are over 100 parallels that can be drawn comparing him to Jesus as a type. But more than that, we reminded what Jesus said in John chapter 5 when he was speaking to the Pharisees, the leaders who were questioning him. He says, "You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life. And these are they which testify of me." Jesus said, all these scriptures are written of me. In fact, he said, if you believe Moses, you would believe me also, for Moses wrote of me. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, and Moses, Jesus said, wrote of him. I believe it's not just he's found in each of the books, but I think he's found in each of the chapters. I think there's so much about Jesus that we need to discover in the Old Testament scriptures, and Joseph is probably one of the most amazing features. But listen, more than that, Joseph becomes for us an amazing example, a model of the believer. One who trusted God in a life-altering event in his life. Who trusts God through life-altering events. Who trusts God and God shows his sovereignty in life-altering situations. And listen, each one of us, we're not immune to some life-changing situations, circumstances, pains, problems, things that we face that we wonder, what is the rhyme or reason to this? You're going to get greatly encouraged with Joseph. Let's jump in. Take a look at him. The first thing we note is, well, he was the son of Jacob. It says in chapter 37, verse 1, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan." Jacob is now living as a sojourner. He finally gets it. Remember, we left him learning the hard way, living a little too close to the Canaanites. His daughter was defiled. His sons behaved, well, atrociously. And they become a poor witness because he had settled down too close. He was living too close to the world. A choice that sometimes we have to make some wise choices within the context of where we are, the decisions we make as families. But now he's beginning to live as he should, a sojourner, just passing through the land of Canaan. And the question for us is really, are we? The Bible calls us pilgrims and aliens, strangers and aliens, that this is not our home. We're foreigners in a foreign land. As believers, do you see that? You've been born from above. There's something this world does not fit in your life anymore. You're just passing through. You're biding your time. You're making the most of your opportunities here, but you understand this is all about prep time for eternity. And amazingly, Jacob gets this, and I think when we get it, it changes the whole context of our lives. All of a sudden, holding onto this world as tightly as we've done before, we let go and we go, okay, Lord, whatever you want to put in and take out, I'm available, whatever you have. Life becomes so much better. The joy of the Lord is our strength. We see his purpose even in things that don't make sense to us in the beginning. So Jacob has gotten to this point, but of course, it's important to pass that on to the next generation. This is the history of Jacob, it says in this verse. The history of Jacob. Literally, the generations of Jacob. The word Toledoth, the genealogy of Jacob. Now, we looked last chapter. We didn't really go through it verse by verse. I challenge you to read it. I doubt most of you did. Just can't motivate you to read through a genealogy, can I? Tough. But that was the history of Esau, the generations of Esau. 43 verses of all his chiefs and kings and all the people that came from his lineage in the Edomite civilization. And now we come to the history or generations of Jacob. Now, I want you to contrast this because it says Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. Wait a minute, I know Jacob had more sons. Why is he saying this is the generations of Jacob? And he says, Joseph. Because what you're going to discover, the very hope of the world, to survive is going to be wrapped up in this 17-year-old kid. Everything about Jacob is going to be passed on to this young lad who is essentially learning the lessons as a young lad and is going to make a huge difference. His life is going to save millions. And I think if you were to, most of us would look at the kings and chiefs and be impressed by the genealogy of Esau. And if we were doing a business plan, we'd probably include some of his notables. And if we had to make a choice between all of those notables and a 17-year-old kid, well, you do the math. But not God. God has a special plan. And so often in our own lives, you know, we look too often, we judge too quickly. We look at the appearance of a situation and we make our determination. Instead of waiting and going, okay, God, I don't understand, but you know, I'm going to trust you. And all right, this is the generations of Jacob. It's all about Joseph. Joseph being 17 years old. Now, I like this because the kings of Edom were powerful, but hey, Joseph was a godly 17-year-old. Esau was all about money and power. And yet Joseph had his eyes on the Lord. How did he get there? We're not really told much about his upbringing. But we can piece together some things that I think are essential to know about Joseph. His early lessons, which I believe greatly influenced him. As a young child, he would have been very, very young and obviously special of his father, the firstborn of his beloved Rachel. When Jacob came back from dealing with Laban and then facing Esau, having that night of wrestling with God, Joseph would have remembered his dad coming back with a limp, having been touched by the angel. And I'm sure that he would have learned the story of Jacob's encounter. He would have observed the way his older brothers behaved, Simeon and Levi, and be appalled at that. The way his sister Dinah was defiled by the Shechemites. He would have watched his father decide to put away the idols and return to Bethel. I want to tell you something about young kids. They can't be taught, but what they pick up can be caught. And I think in many ways, you know, it's futile for us to try to teach our children if we are not going to model it. And I believe Jacob is beginning to model that life. His older sons, of course, would have seen a lot of his bad examples, and naturally they're a whole lot like him. Deceiving, focused on this world, conniving. But you see, after he's encountered God, now Joseph is old enough to see that part of him. He's able to see the Israel part of him. And I believe that had an impact. When he was about 13, his father would have showed him Bethel, where he had that first encounter with God. Huge impressions on a young man. I think the junior high age is so, so vastly important. Do you know that most people who will become Christians do so in their teen years? They make up their mind to follow the Lord. Junior high kids, so important to see that model. Now listen, here's the problem. If you're a junior high kid here, maybe you're high school, maybe you're here, whatever. Listen, to you, I'm just a talking head. That's all I am. Because, you know, frankly, you know, you don't see my life. You don't see what I'm like. You don't see my example. And perhaps you wonder, well, am I for real? What am I really like when I'm at home? What do I do privately? What TV shows do I like? What do I watch in movies? What do I go to on the internet? What do I do for enjoyment? What temptations have I encountered and how have I overcome? You can't see that. I could tell you, but it'd just be words. But listen, a parent, someone that is living it, is going to have an infinitely more powerful influence on someone. And I know for my own life, that godly example was essential when I was a young man. I weep for kids that don't have that at home. And there are many, sadly, because I know. I hear the stories. And I know that your kids, you know, they know you're one way at home and another way at church, many of you. And I weep for that because, you know, I feel for them because they're going to have a huge disadvantage because they're going to wonder, does this really even work? Is this just junk? Is this just words? I want to tell you something. They need an example. And I weep for parents and guardians if they don't provide that example. Put away those idols and make up their mind to follow the Lord. I weep for that next generation. And let me tell you, if you're young and you don't have that model at home, that's okay. You're not unusual. But you can find that model. There are some godly people that God has put in your life. You seek them out, you'll find them. And you can watch them because you're going to catch it much easier than you're going to be able to be taught it. You're going to see it. Now, so let's look here. I think those early lessons, it says in the last part of verse 2, he says, the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And then it throws out, Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, I'm going to warn you that at first glance, our first impression of Joseph is not a good one. Because, you know, right here, I mean, we could easily say, you little tattletale. You know, you little talebearer. But let's go on, because we might have a different opinion of that as we keep looking. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. Okay, a second reason why we don't like him. Naturally, he seems to be the teacher's pet, his father's favorite. Favoritism is in a home. Oh, no, favoritism. This is horrible. But I have to question that for one reason. Remember what happened to the firstborn, Reuben. The firstborn, remember, they got the lion's share of the inheritance. They were the main heir. They got 51% of the corporation, the controlling interest. And Reuben was a disappointment. He either got ambitious or he fell into his lust. Neither way, he slept with his father's other wives, that, you know, one of his brother's mothers. He slept with her. And, of course, I believe he was disposed from being firstborn. Now, Jacob has every right. The prerogative is his to choose who he wants to be the firstborn now. Because Reuben has relinquished that. Levi and Simeon have already disappointed him. Judah, well, he's going to be, but he's not quite ready yet, perhaps. And in any case, we understand that Jacob chose Joseph. How do we know? Well, it says he made him a tunic of many colors, or a coat that was special. The many colors is actually a translated term that the translators are trying to make the best of this one Hebrew word, pasam, literally means palms. And of course, some have said, well, it was richly ornamented, many colored, whatever. They try to give us some meaning to that. But some believe that it simply means that it went to the wrists and it went to the ankles. Unlike a working man's cloak, which would have been shorter, so you wouldn't trip while you're working, and sleeveless, so you could work. This was an overseer's coat, and by doing that is signaling out Joseph as now the next one that's going to be the heir, the main firstborn, the one who's now the overseer of the brothers. Now, this would explain the bad report, wouldn't it? He brings back a report about their evil doings. And if you weren't asked for this report, I mean, he would be a talebearer, right? That's what a talebearer does. He doesn't have any official business. He just is busy telling everybody about anyone else's business. But here's an overseer. You see, he has to bring back a report to his father. He's doing what he's supposed to do. Now, think about it. It would be much easier for him to make peace with his brothers. Hey, looking, guys, I saw that, but listen, I'm not going to tell Dad. Hey, thanks, Joseph. We love you, and we know you. They would have loved him. But let me ask you a question. Do you think it's noble to tell a lie? Hey, Dad, everything's cool out there, in order to not hurt somebody? If you think so, then I think your priorities may be askew. Isn't it right to be honorable before God rather than before man? Now, again, no need to be a talebearer to bring a report that you're not asked to bring. But, you know, as an overseer, if you fudge the truth, the owner of the company is going to make decisions based on incorrect information. The whole company could be jeopardized. Someone's sleeping at their post and the overseer sees it and doesn't do anything. The enemy could slip in. But there's another way to confirm that Joseph was indeed the one that was chosen to be the firstborn or the heir, is that in John chapter 4, verse 5, Jesus at the well, the Bible tells us, when he met that woman by the well, it was a well near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. That confirms he was conferred the one that was in charge, even though he's the younger. But what do you think that does to the average person? See, just reading this makes us, we don't like him immediately because he's a young guy in charge. And there's something unfair about that to us, isn't it? And that doesn't that bother you a little bit? Come on, let's be honest. So why did he get chosen? It's not fair. I mean, we've been in this family a lot longer. We've worked hard for you, Dad. We've been there and we've handled the weight of everything. This young kid, he hasn't done anything. Why should he? Now, this is how we think. And, you know, it's natural to think that way. But here's the thing. God is going to slip this in so many times throughout the Bible. It is going to challenge your thoughts because we have this kind of picture about what is fair and what is not fair. Remember the parable Jesus told about the man who went out to find some workers to work in his field. He found some guys in the beginning of the day. Hey, come on, work for me. I'll give you a day's wage. All right, work. Great. So they're out there working in the field. Half the day goes by and he sees some other guys. Hey, what are you doing sitting here? You know, I've got work to do. Why don't you go in the field? I'll pay you whatever's fair. All right, great. So they go and work. And then he finds guys at the very last hour of the day, still not work. Well, you guys aren't working? Look, you can still get some things done. Why don't you go? Probably another hour, but I'll pay you whatever's fair. So they go and work. At the end of the day, he settles the account with each of those laborers. The first ones that just work for an hour, he gives them a whole day's wage. Whoa, dude, thanks. The next guys who were half a day, same thing, day's wage. Oh, okay, well, that's cool. Comes to the last guys who are working all day, gives them a day's wage. They grumble. What's this? That ain't fair. We've been working out here all day. Now listen, every one of you sitting there by nature would think, yeah, you're right, that isn't fair. That's not right. That's not good. Let me tell you something. God's going to do that to you every day of your life. And I'll tell you why. The answer to the man was, look, I negotiated for a day's wage for you and I paid you what I told you. Why am I not fair if I want to be generous to these others? And listen, this is the whole point. Does not God have the prerogative to choose? Does not Jacob have the prerogative to choose? Listen, if you are the president of the company, don't you want to reserve that right to yourself, the prerogative to choose? And if workers come to you and say, why are you doing this? Why are you letting this guy? Why are you doing it? Listen, I'm the president. We have a hard time with that, don't we? Authority. And I think when we look at God, we struggle with what we perceive as fair or unfair. And of course, that's why we don't like Joseph immediately. But I want to change that view. Joseph is being faithful to a charge even as a young man, even though he's not going to be liked for it. He's faithful to honor his father and honor God. But of course, verse 4, we see the natural response. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now, there's some reasons, or what I would say, some pictures of Joseph here. The first thing we notice is he was loved by his father. Now, in that way, in many ways, he becomes a type of Christ, too. He's the beloved of the father. The brothers don't have a case. They hate him without a cause. Just like Jesus, the Bible tells us, was hated without a cause. That is a cause in him. There was a reason they hated him. It was envy. But there was no cause in him to hate him. Jesus, when he came into Jerusalem, they cried, Hosanna, Hosanna. But it wasn't long after they cried, crucify him, crucify him. And he went to the cross alone, falsely accused, abandoned. Though the Bible says he did no sin, nor was any guile found in him. And when he was reviled, he didn't revile back. He was like a lamb before the shearers, silent. Now Joseph had a dream, verse 5, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brother said to him, verse 8, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. But what I see here is another good thing. Now again, your initial reaction is, what a little self-righteous punk. He has a little dream and he's got to brag to his brothers. Now again, that's how we look at this. But listen, this was no ordinary dream, I'm certain of that. It's not like a normal dream you have and it's kind of some weird dream and you don't tell anybody about your dream. You probably dream 100 times and never mention a dream to anybody. But there's something about this dream. I believe Joseph understands this is a divine revelation. And when he tells his dream, he may have felt it would be unwise not to. Wouldn't it be wrong of him to withhold a divine revelation? Let me ask you this. Do you not tell people about Jesus, the gospel of God, the divine revelation about how they can be saved through the Son of God who loved them and died for them, because you feel that you may not be well received, or they'll hate you for it, or they'll look at you like you're some holier than thou? I have to tell you, that is probably one of the biggest reasons why we have a difficulty sharing the good news with someone else. It's because we don't want to be looked at like we're some holier than thou. And frankly, you know, I think of many ways, you know, he's like a young believer here. He's relishing in this new special relationship with his father. And it raises the ire of his brothers, the envy, that ugly sin. And I have to remember when I first became a Christian, when I first turned my life over to the Lord really, and when I was 18 years old. And I can remember that next summer, just 6 months later, going out to see my sisters. I couldn't wait to tell them what had happened to me. Now that I'd been 6 months as a believer, I knew a little bit about the Bible, and I was just so excited. And I remember gathering them in the kitchen. I still remember the look on their faces. I remember where everything in the kitchen. I just remember this. And I was so excited. I guess I gotta tell you guys, I became a Christian. And they looked at me and then looked at each other and burst out laughing. That was how it started for me. I thought, it's going to be a long road. But it wasn't just a week before the Lord got a hold of my sister. She'd been smoking marijuana all day and woke up in the middle of the night with her heart pounding and God speaking to her heart that what I said was true. And she got on her knees and prayed to receive the Lord that day. And from that point on, has been growing in the Lord. Now she's a missionary in Mexico. So, you know, you never know. Again, but if Joseph had worried about what his brothers were going to think, he would have held that dream to himself. If he were more shrewd or wise, he might not have said anything. But would that have been right? If it's God's dream, if it's a divine revelation. You know, the real sin here is pretty obvious. Then he dreamed and still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers, listen, this is the sin, envied him. But his father kept the matter in mind. His father initially rebukes him, but then his father begins to think, wonder what's going to go on with this kid. Remember what Mary, she pondered in her heart the things that were said. And envy is the real thing. The real sin comes out. His brothers envy him. Their envy is going to be nursed and fumed into hatred, and the hatred is going to eventually be turned into full-blown murderous thoughts. Envy is a horrible thing. It's an ugly sin. I don't think we see it like that, though. I think we see it as normal. We cater to it so often. We try to make everything fair with people. And I wonder if that's not, well, more fear of man than fear of God. What does God want? I tell you, it's a hard thing to do. It doesn't matter how long you've been in the Lord, it's still a challenge. But the Proverbs 14, verse 30 says, "A sound heart is life to the body, but envy is rottenness to the bones." James tells us in chapter 3, verse 16, if you're taking notes, "Where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there." Every evil thing can come out of envy. Envy is man's resistance to God's decrees. Cain didn't like it that Abel's offering was accepted and his wasn't. He was envious, and that's what called him to kill his brother. Korah was envious of Moses' leadership, and it caused him to rebel. "Who do you think you are, Moses? We're all holy, the whole congregation. What makes you so special?" Well, God chose him. That's what made him special. Saul was envious over David. Remember the song that he heard the lady sing? "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." Saul's over there going, "Why do they ascribe tens of thousands to David and only thousands to me?" You know, it's all a matter of comparison, isn't it? That's why we're so careful how we give our kids gifts. You know, it's got to be fair. Church splits and all kinds of other evil things happen. Jesus going to the cross, the Bible tells us it was because of envy he was delivered up. And listen, the root of bitterness from envy leads to the fruit of bitterness. In verse 12, we're going to see the sordid tale here. It says, "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them.' So he said to him, 'Here I am.' In love of his father and obedience to his father, he goes." Hebron is already 20 miles south of Jerusalem, and Shechem is 30 miles north of Jerusalem. So it's a 50-mile journey to get to Shechem. I mean, on foot, you're talking 2, 3, maybe 4 days, depending on your rate. So he says, "Here I am, I'll go." Then he said, "Well, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." It's so much like the father sending his son into the world for the benefit of his people. Joseph is sent for the brothers to make sure that they're okay. "I'm worried about them. Is everything okay? Bring back word to me." And he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him. There he was wandering in the field. He's out there in Shechem looking around. The man says, "What are you seeking?" He said, "Well, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they're feeding their flocks." And the man said, "Well, they've departed from here. I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan, which is another 14 miles north. So now 64-mile journey. But it says in verse 18, "When they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let's now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we'll say some wild beast has devoured him, and we'll see what will become of his dreams.'" You know, it's amazing how similar this is to the attack upon Jesus as they madly rush to get him crucified, all under the pretext, "Well, we'll see what becomes of your prophecies. You say you're the Son of God. You say you're God's man. Well, we'll see. If you're the Messiah, come down from that cross." The mockery and the hatred that came out in that day, this envy that drove these brothers to a murderous act. What I'm noting is Joseph is only there out of love for his father and love for his brothers. You know, he's vulnerable because of love, and he put himself through much trouble to find them, and they're taking advantage of Joseph's love of his father and love for them, the same way the Pharisees took advantage of Jesus' love, because he would not fight for himself. Because if Jesus had saved himself, listen, if Jesus had saved himself, we could not be saved. And the people that crucified him could not be saved. And no one could be saved unless Jesus pays the price, his perfect life for ours. Joseph, in a way, is going to go through some amazing challenges in his life. This is just the beginning. But unless those challenges happen, the whole nation is going to perish. So in many ways, he's like Jesus in this. Now, Reuben, of course, God bless Reuben for giving some attempt. Verse 21, Reuben heard it and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let's not kill him." And he makes an authoritative statement as the oldest. "No, we're not going to kill him." And Reuben said, "Shed no blood, but cast him in this pit which is in the wilderness and don't lay a hand on him." But we're told that it was because he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. He's hoping to bide his time, keep him in the pit, and when they're not looking, bring him out and bring him back to the father. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers. Now he's coming. They've already decided what they're going to do. They stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty and there was no water. And it was a dried up well, probably, 15, 20 feet down, maybe even longer. And couldn't climb out of it and might have injured himself throwing him down there. And they sat down. Listen, verse 25 is probably the most callous expression that you can even read. And they sat down to eat a meal. Even more callous was later when we find out in Genesis 42 that they referred to this moment. He says, "Remember when we saw the anguish of his soul and he pleaded with us and we would not hear?" So right here, while they're having a meal, they're within earshot of his cries and pleas. And what are you doing, Asher? Gad? Simeon? Levi? What's happening here? Judah? Why are you doing this to me? I can only imagine how he must have pleaded. "Guys, come on. This is a bad joke. Come on. What are you doing?" And he's in the pit. Guys, I hurt my ankle. What are you doing to me? And he's crying, don't leave me here. Well, guys, hey, somebody. And they're out there having a joke, eating a meal. You know what? Don't ever underestimate the power of envy, what that can do. You nurse that in your heart, and it will produce some bad fruit. Listen, it's a stain on the heart. And there's only one way that stain can be cleansed, and that is by the blood of Jesus Christ, because that is our human nature. We are always too busy comparing ourselves with others, aren't we? And we find it necessary to tear somebody down to make us look better oftentimes. That's the worldly way, but that's not the way the Lord puts in our heart now. As a believer, we are not to be that way. And I look at these brothers acting this way. Sit down and eat a meal, and then they lift their eyes and look. There was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. And as they're listening to these cries of their brother, someone said this: you could mathematically calculate the time it took for the cries of Joseph to reach their eardrums. Whatever that time was, whatever split second that was, but you have to understand, though it only took a split second for that sound to reach their eardrums, it took 22 years for the words from those eardrums to hit down into their hearts. 22 years before they finally feel the weight of what they've done. Well, Judah steps up in verse 26 and said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. Now, Judah, in a way, saves his life. Later is really a stand-up guy. But I got to tell you, this is a hypocritical speech if I've ever heard one. For after all, he is our brother. Let's make some money on him. The Midianite traders passed by. The brothers pulled up Joseph, lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. I can only imagine Joseph saying, "Guys, you're not serious." Pleading with them, "I'm your brother." So they sell their brother into slavery. Robert Burns called it man's inhumanity to man. How far will people go in cruelty? They study what happens to people who are cruel to people. It breeds more cruelty. The more cruel you treat a prisoner, the more you hate them and the more cruel you'll be to them. What happened in Nazi Germany? You can see the extent of human cruelty. But don't think our sophisticated age has done anything to change the heart of man, as we also witness such atrocities and murders and perversions affecting the next generation, and a heart hardened. Nothing can compare to the shocking inhumanity of one's own brother selling Joseph, who's crying out to them, except perhaps people who cried, crucify him, to one who did no wrong. Then Reuben returned to the pit. Apparently he wasn't there when the negotiations were made. And indeed, Joseph wasn't in the pit, and he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? What am I going to do now?" Now, I have to tell you, Reuben, you're a little too late here. You may have spared his life, but you might have planned and intended to do something wonderful. But just to throw it off by saying, "Well, what can I do now? Where do I go now?" I think is not really a good answer. It's really kind of another picture of the wickedness in our hearts. You know, not speaking up in due time, and then when it's too late, we excuse ourselves. "Well, I can't do anything about it now." If Reuben was truly sincere, do you think it would have been too hard to follow the route to the Midianites, pay them double or triple to get your brother back? But now comes the cover-up, verse 31. They took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. They sent the tunic of many colors. They brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Do you know whether it's your son's or not?" Trying to play coy. And he recognized it. Of course, they don't want to actually lie. So they discovered a way to not fully tell the truth. And he recognized it and said, "It's my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him, and without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." You know, it's interesting to me. I don't know if you are aware of this, but remember Jacob deceived his father with goat skin, and now he's being deceived by his sons with goat's blood. What goes around comes around. You know, what a hard lesson. Well, Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son for many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. It looks bad. It looks real bad for Jacob. But wait, it's not the end of the story. We look at this story, and if we stopped right there, like, what in the world? But there's so much going to happen here. Joseph, his life, listen, God is using the little things, little links in the chain, tiny circumstances along the journey of life to affect huge possibilities. Joseph, it's needful. Later we'll find it was needful for him to be taken to Egypt, to be raised up in Egypt, thus to save millions of lives. And he does. He is the savior of the world in many ways. All of this would have never happened had it not been for that stupid coat. Think about it. A special coat conferring leadership upon him rises the envy of his brothers. They sell him. He finds his way to Egypt. So much so, you see, it's God's hand at work. Blaise Pascal wrote how this fits Christ so much. He said of Joseph, innocent, loved of his father, sent by his father to see his brother, sold for 20 pieces of silver, and then becomes their Lord and savior of strangers, and savior of the whole world. And none of this would have occurred without the plot to destroy him, sell him, and their rejection. And in prison, later we'll find Joseph was innocent between two notable prisoners, as Jesus on the cross between two thieves. And he prophesies of the salvation of one and of the death of the other, just as Jesus does. It's an amazing parallel. But Joseph's life illustrates more than ever one verse that I would hope every believer should have written in their Bible, underlined, marked, and memorized. And it's Romans 8:28. How many of you know that by heart, just out of curiosity, Romans 8:28? Quite a few of you. Many more of you need to. The Bible tells us in Romans 8:28, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and are the called according to his purpose. Joseph is a model for the believer, not just a type of Christ. He's one you want to emulate. One who, listen, from the time he gets to Egypt, away from his home, in a new place, he could have adopted the Egyptian lifestyle, forgotten about who he was, who his God is. God, if you left me and abandoned me, then I'm going to live like the Egyptians. But no, he never forgets who he was. He never complains, and he never compromises. And as a result, he keeps growing. You see, I think that Joseph probably knew what was told Abraham long ago. It was passed on through Isaac and then through Jacob, and I'm sure Joseph would have heard it. That our descendants are going to grow into a mighty nation, but we'll be foreigners in a foreign land, and then we'll come out. And I think Joseph might be piecing it together here. Maybe we're meant to go to Egypt. Maybe this is where it's going to begin. But listen, God was the key. Whether sold as a slave or in prison or in second in command, Joseph honors God. Now, for some life lessons in this series, we're going to discover some very interesting things if you stay with us. Do you want to know how to overcome envy? Face adversity? Resist sexual temptation? Plan for the future? Forgive those who have deeply hurt you? Have complete faith in God and his promises? Rest in God's sovereignty no matter what? This series is for you. Great lessons of our lives as we understand through Joseph. So verse 36 says, the Midianites, they sold him to Egypt, sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. I think he was probably picked because he was a standout. There was something special about his countenance. I think just like Daniel stood out so that he was able to make a special request. He was not like all the simpering, whimpering other young men processed who'd seen their parents killed and dragged off to a foreign country and are going through trauma. Daniel trusted God and the trauma didn't hit him because he knew, Lord, whatever, you know what's best. I'll trust you in this. And I believe Joseph as well. And so God now has his man in Egypt. He's setting this up. Now the big question is, let me ask you this. Joseph, who'd you rather be? Would you rather be Joseph here, enslaved, away from home, with God, or his brothers, with blood-stained coat and a defiled conscience? What would you rather be? Joseph may have been stripped of his coat, but he can't be stripped of his God, and he won't be stripped of his character. And I hope that you understand you can't be stripped of your God. Nothing can separate you from God. Neither life, nor death, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, things to come. Nothing can separate you from the love of God. I hope you know that. But it's your choice if you can be stripped of your character. If you let your integrity falter. And that's one thing I think we will be all encouraged with Joseph, because you know what? As he honored God, God honored him and raised him up. Instead of conforming to Egypt, he purposes in his heart, just like Daniel, to stay strong, to do the right thing, even when he's falsely accused. Follow Joseph's life, even his own testimony. You're going to find it's all about God. He's going to say as a slave when he's tempted with Potiphar's wife, "How can I sin against God?" He's going to say to the prisoners in prison after he's in prison for that false accusation of Potiphar's wife. He's going to say to them, "Don't interpretations belong to God?" when they have a dream. He's going to say to Pharaoh, "I can't give the interpretation of your dream, but God can." He brings God into everything. He says to his brothers when it's finally revealed to them, he said, "God sent me ahead to preserve you. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." See, Joseph's perspective in life, that God is on the throne, gives him that power. He even says to his father Jacob, "These are the sons God gave me." And then reminds them, "When God brings you up out of this place, and he will one day, bring my bones with you." Joseph's life was all about God, and that's his secret. And so we've just got the introduction to this 17-year-old kid. But how God is going to use him is amazing. I want to tell you something. Don't underestimate how God can use you if you'll but believe. I know some here have fully consecrated their life and they've known. And so they can look at life and they can see it from this perspective. The Lord knows. See, all these little pieces we can't piece together. None of it makes sense from our perspective. But when you trust God, you believe he's going to weave it all together in the perfect plan. And some of the dark points of our life just become the perfect contrast in the portrait that he's making. Because you can't have a beautiful painting without some contrast. And you'll look sometimes at those dark moments in your life and you'll realize, wow, now I understand God. The pain, the suffering, maybe you won't. Maybe some of you are here thinking, yeah, there's no rhyme or reason and I'll never accept there's any reason for this. Well, I'm sorry for you. Because you are missing the big picture. And but hopefully, maybe as you continue at least to trust him as much as you can, maybe he'll be merciful to reveal that big picture to you. But it's only when you can rise up and greet it and even thank God for it. Because God is working out all things together for good. How can you not thank him, even in the midst of some of the dark moments? Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Certainly doesn't in our understanding. But this is where it all comes down to. Will you trust in him? God sent his only begotten son into this world. And you know, we have a hard time surrendering the throne of our life, just like his brothers had a hard time accepting Joseph as their leader. We have a hard time accepting God to be the leader of our lives. So we think we know better. We want to be in charge. We want to be in control. But when we finally surrender and believe that unless I trust him, I cannot be saved. Unless I believe what Jesus did on the cross, dying for my sins, I cannot be saved. I'll have no hope. I can't stand before a holy and perfect God. If I believe that, then I'm going to trust him. I'm going to put my life in his hands. I'm going to follow him. And of course, by doing so, you're going to have made a lot of enemies in the world. And it'll be a challenge for you. But I encourage you, grow. God is sovereign in these life-altering events. You've had some life-altering events already in your life, perhaps. Maybe not. God is sovereign.